In this week's programme, the thoughts of one of the most acute analysts of the modern world, Svetlan Todorov. He's director of research at the National Centre for Scientific Research in Paris. In his book, The Fear of Barbarians, he argues that it's our fear of the barbarian enemy that is likely to turn us into barbarians ourselves. For example, when all is permitted in the fight against terror, the counter-terrorist becomes indistinguishable from the terrorist. Apart from the temptation of fear, we're also beset by the lure of simplification, of reducing complex global issues to simple confrontations between Islam and the free world, between East and West. It's for that reason he's deeply critical of Samuel Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations, because Huntington implies that all global conflicts have their origin in religion. With me, Tom Garvin, Emeritus Professor of Politics at UCD, and Ivana Batrick, former Reed Professor of Criminal Law at Trinity College, Dublin. Tom, what did you think of the book?
Well, the book is really an extended meditation on Huntington's book, which came out in the early 90s. And it's a book that I regard as a very dangerous book. When it was translated into Farsi, the entire edition was confiscated and distributed among the leadership of the Republican Guard. They were taking their enemy's definition of the situation and applying it to themselves. Mm. In other words, there is truth in Todorov's argument that you become like your enemy. And if you define the enemy in a certain way, you make him more like that and you will become more like it yourself. I think there's a real truth in that. And what Huntington did was he looked around and he found there were no more communists. The Soviet Union had collapsed. Now, America has to have an enemy, as Updike put it many years ago. So he decided to invent an enemy for the United States, and he nominated Islam. He invented also a sort of pseudo, Toynbee-esque view of history, that human beings are divided up into civilizations that are more or less antithetical to each other. He invents Japan as a civilization, for example, and there's a thing called the West that includes us and the Americans, but not the Latin Americans, which is quite interesting. But basically, he's aiming at Islam.
And as Todorov says,
he is reinforcing certain forces within Islam that agree with him.
Yeah,
but that has been the real problem.
But he's also saying religion is really the explanation for everything, for all those changes. I mean, that's Todorov's criticism of Huntington. What did you think of it, Ivana?
I thought it was fascinating and in some ways slightly frustrating, because it has that somewhat pompous French academic style. Uh-huh. One never knows, of course, whether it's the translation or whether in the original text it would have read the same way. But certainly there was some language in it that I thought was unnecessarily obtuse, you know. But at the same time, the thesis is very interesting. And as Thomas said, it really is a very strong critique of Huntington and this idea that civilizations must always be in a clash, you know, that you have what he calls Manichaean. Now, I had to look up that word, but he's essentially, it's an argument against Manichaeanism, against always having to see things in terms of polar opposites, in terms of binary divides. So he's attacking that idea of the world as binary, a war between light and evil. And he's attacking that, as Thomas said, particularly where it arose in Samuel Huntington's argument that, you know, the Cold War has been replaced by the clash of the West versus Islam. Yeah. And Todorov's idea, or his sort of counter-argument, is that it's much better and much more correct to see the world in terms of pluralities. So he's really, you know, it's a very powerful argument and very persuasive that, for example, Islam is not a monolith. The West is not a monolith. That there are many multiple cultures within it. And he strips it right back to the individual, and he says each individual has a multiplicity of cultures. I particularly liked his little postscript at the end where he talks about his own different cultural background, that he came to France as a Bulgarian national at the age of 24. He became French at some point. But he says that doesn't mean that he's turned his back on the first quarter century of his life. Mm. So he himself has multiple identities and is.
I wonder to what extent, I'm thinking, you know, about his rejection of these kind of binary simplicities. But when Reagan referred to an empire of evil, I mean, there are those who would argue that that worked. I mean, that it had, you know, it was an effective piece of rhetoric.
Well, there were two sets of Manichaeans there. There were the Americans under Reagan, and there were the Russians, or the Soviets, if you like, under a gerontocratic leadership that was dying out. Mm. They actually believed in the early 80s that when the Americans went on an economic saving kick, they start turning the lights off in the office buildings at night, that they were saving oil for a first strike against the Soviet Union. They had no idea about Western economics whatsoever. They didn't understand it. They really didn't understand it. And the West didn't understand the Soviet Union's paranoia about them.
So you had two worlds.
You had two sets of Manichaeans looking at each other. And the trouble is, and I think Todorov is quite right, what happened to Huntington, and I knew him quite well, back in the 80s, he is a Manichaean. He sees enemies everywhere. Mm. Or he did. You know, the poor chap is dead now. But the first thing he did, he asked me, was, were there many communists in Ireland? And I tried to explain to him, this is in the early 80s, that actually the nationalists in Ireland are far more dangerous than the communists. Because communists tended to think their way out of communism. The nationalists could never think their way out of nationalism. And he just could not understand what I was saying. That I was being anti-Manichaean from his point of view. I was offering a third view, if you like, that I thought was just as valid as the other two views, at least. Yes. And he wouldn't talk to me afterwards for quite a long time.
I suppose, in a way, it's a bit unfair. Todorov, just coming back to Huntington, Todorov is a little bit unfair in Huntington, isn't he? Because it is a general human desire to compartmentalise, to split things up, to compare and contrast. And so Huntington's book had a huge influence, I suppose, partly because people just wanted to see the world in that simple way.
It broke through the barrier between academia and popular readership. That's no doubt about that. But it was actually turned into a declaration of war or something like a declaration of war. Yeah. And I think that's what Todorov is really objecting to, very gently and in a very French.
Let's look at Todorov's ideas and barbarism. You know, he well asked, what is it? And he has a useful distinction between relative and absolute varieties of it. I mean, that a relative expression of it would be when you talk about somebody, the barbarian is someone who has a different language.
Yeah.
To what I have, and then a more absolute approach to a definition would be to say, to look at it in terms of more universal criteria, like saying that particular group is cruel, acts in a cruel way. How useful did you find that?
Well, a barbarian is somebody who doesn't speak Greek. A Persian who would be highly civilized and all the rest of it would be a barbarian in the eyes
That's the relative.
It didn't mean a savage.
Sure, that's
it meant a foreigner.
That's the relative use of it.
It was turned into the savagery thing comes in later.
Sure,
and
sure.
I think around the time of Alexander.
Yeah.
I suppose this is where I felt Todorov, you know, one could be critical of Todorov. And while it's a very persuasive argument that we should stop seeing the world in terms of clashes of civilizations, that it is, you know, that we deny humanity in others when we call them barbarians, his argument, he follows Levi Strauss's argument. He quotes Levi Strauss, the barbarian is the man who believes in barbarism, because that's the man or the person who doesn't believe in the humanity of others. And that itself is barbaric. So, you know, he's making a very persuasive argument about that, about the need to appreciate pluralities and complexities within what might appear as monolithic cultures. But at the same time, towards, I suppose, in the latter half of the book, I felt that he still can't help but fall into the same trap of Huntington, albeit that he's presenting it in a more sophisticated way. You know, the last chapter in European Identity, he's talked about the danger of the use of torture and the use of barbaric tactics in a civilization. But he says in an earlier chapter, there is this difficulty. How do we distinguish between acceptable traditions and what is an unacceptable antithesis to democracy? And I think the problem is that you end up being, and he talks about the danger of being judgmental, but you end up being judgmental. And in his chapter on the European identity in particular, I felt that ultimately what he's talking about, and I don't know if this is wrong, you know, I actually in some ways agree with him, but what he's saying is there is a European identity based on a plurality of cultures, sort of like the ancient Greece city-states, where different states have autonomy and have different languages and different cultures, but there is a European identity, there's a cohabitation of nations within Europe. He calls this cosmopolitanism, he's very approving of this. To me, this just sounds like another way of saying we're the civilised ones. Now,
Europe really include America?
Well, I think.
Well, we see, and this is where you get back into.
I've had this argument with Americans. I've always said you are Europeans.
I thought his point about Europe was
they get very annoyed.
I thought his central point about Europe was that there are three kinds of identity that have been separated in the EU, for example. He says cultural identity, which would be, say, in our case, the idea that we might say we have a Gaelic past that you and I were talking about earlier. There's a civic identity, which would be some reference to the country. And then he says an identity based on subscribing to common values. He does ask a good question here. Which of those commands most loyalty? For which of those allegiances are we prepared to die, Tom?
Well, Well, I wouldn't ask for the death penalty, you know. Where do we emigrate to? Where do we emigrate to? Yeah. We don't emigrate to France or Germany.
Yeah.
We emigrate to America or Britain or Australia. In other words, we are English speakers, first of all, rather than Europeans, I suspect.
Someone asked Tom Murphy, where is Ireland going? And he said, mostly abroad, which I suppose is the truth.
But I suppose, just to come back to this idea of European identity, more sophisticated idea. Sure. I mean, he says himself, very few Europeans would die for any of those identities now, because we've moved beyond that idea. Mm. And so but to me, as I say, it sounds like he's saying Europeans are actually more civilised. Now, is that wrong? I think in a way
is he not suggesting that? Do you think implicitly?
Implicitly, that's the message, is that while he's saying we shouldn't be judgmental of other cultures, we should never describe cultures that are not Western, for example, as barbaric. Mm. And he's right about that. But at the same time, he at the end speaks more approvingly of European identity and the plurality of cultures.
A little bit ad hominem here. Yeah. Todorov starts off in Bulgaria. He learns a Slav language as a child. He presumably knows something about the Greek Orthodox Church. He goes to France and he becomes French. His second language is French. He's far more European than you or I are.
Yeah,
you
know, on the other hand...
He's got two mainland languages for a start. And he doesn't have this alternative world called the English-speaking world,
which we've got. But he offers... You're suggesting, really, in a way, Evander, that he's something of an essentialist as far as Europe was concerned. But let me finish. But here he is critical of Pope Benedict for suggesting that the heart of Europe is some kind of confluence of the Greco-Roman and the Christian. He's saying, no, you've got to add in other components, such as the Celtic and the Persians, indeed. You know, other writers do. So to that degree, I don't think he's an essentialist about, in the sense of saying this is what Europe is about. Oh, no, because your point is that he's saying whatever it is superior, is that it?
I think that's right, yes. Yeah. Just to tease it out a bit. I mean, he's saying that European identity is more inclusive, that European civilization is more inclusive than it might have been thought in the past, that we should be much more accepting of other cultures. His fourth chapter is fascinating, where he looks at different issues, you know, the killing of Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands, the Danish cartoon controversy, the Pope's speech.
Yeah.
And in all of those, he's saying, for instance, the Pope's speech was a clumsy mistake, but their overreaction to it was also to be criticised. With the Danish cartoons, I thought he's very interesting. He gives a very interesting argument about that there's a difference, and I read a piece he did in The New Humanist on this as well, where he says that there's a difference between criticising a triumphant ideology, criticising Islam, and criticising a marginalised or persecuted group, in other words, criticising Muslims. So one is an act of courage, the other an act of hatred. It's a very interesting play on this. But he's saying that in Europe, therefore, we should be more tolerant of other cultures, we should be more inclusive, so we should appreciate a plurality. But he's still saying in that last chapter that if you do all this, your civilization is he's more approving of your civilization. Now, I actually think that's a fair point, because I do think that, you know, there are some values of equality and so on that one can't be relativist about. And this is back to the debate.
But he wouldn't say that one should. I mean, he does.
No, he comes back to
this. He would argue, and I think he would have a better time arguing now because of recent events, particularly the Arab Spring, that actually Islam itself is internally divided, is internally pluralist, is far more rich in its internal variety and internal philosophies, if you like, than Europeans give it credit for, perhaps. And all right, our ignorance is, I suppose, partly excusable, because to us, the Arab world or the Islamic world is foreign. They are bewildered by the West. We are bewildered by them. And the funny thing is, as we get to know each other more, they, in many ways, take on some of the attributes of the West and use them against each other. And what has fascinated me about the Arab Spring and the spokespeople at the Arab Spring is how many European languages they spoke. They spoke English, they spoke French, they were speaking German. They were asking for the freedoms that are defined by Western liberal constitutions. They were not talking Al-Qaeda. They were not talking about a caliphate. They were not talking about Sharia law or anything like that at all. They were fed up with dictatorship and bullying and corruption.
Todorov makes some very useful distinctions, doesn't he, between Islam and Islamism, which is, as he points out, is a political movement from the 20s. Nothing really to do with Islam. And then, in turn, Islamism needs to be distinguished from terrorism. So but people pull all those together.
He spotted this 3 or 4 years ago.
French. It's well said well could do. On the question of, you know, he says, if Europe is a secular club, and he seems to think it is, the issue of Turkish admittance to the EU should be no problem. Now, we know the Vatican, for example, is not too keen on Turkish admittance, presumably for that reason.
I think, you know, the book does ask that question, I suppose, implicitly about the broadening of Europe to include other countries on the periphery, and particularly, I suppose, Turkey. I've always thought if I was a feminist in Turkey, as I'm a feminist in the EU, I would be pushing as hard as I could for Turkey to come into the EU. As a feminist in the EU, obviously, I want to make sure that standards of equality in particular are maintained within the EU. But I think we need to be expansive. I think we do need to be expanding to include countries like Turkey, which are democracies, which are based on separation of church and state. And in fact, Todorov talks about some of the, you know, to come back to this idea of essentialism or universalism, he does talk about certain values that he says are we are ready to defend intransigently, that are sort of the set values of civilization, of democracy, the freedom of women to organise personal lives the way they see fit, the separation of the theological and the political, in other words, of church and state. And just talking about the Arab Spring, you know, I suppose it does confirm that his thesis that there are these values of democracy that aren't to be claimed by the West or by anyone's side.
But
in any
on the question of the
idea that they were invented by the West.
Well, then we're coming back to this idea of the Enlightenment, which is, again, a theme throughout his book.
The Enlightenment for him is absolutely central. I mean, is he right in this? I mean, there are those who say, not just the Vatican, that there is a religious Christian component at the heart of Europe. There are people who would argue that.
I think civilizations are rooted in religions. And I think it's historically just unarguable that Western civilization's roots are Christian, and that Christianity was the vehicle through which classical learning, as well as Jewish religious values, were transmitted to the barbarians of Europe over the last 2,000 years.
And you're arguing...
I think that's unarguable.
Hold on, you're arguing that the Enlightenment is a secularising of the Christian tradition.
Yes.
Would you? How do you feel about that, Ivana? Yeah.
Yes, I do. I think he puts it... he quotes Valery to say, you know, European means three great influences have come together to form the European identity: Rome, Jerusalem and Athens. The idea of empire and state power. Jerusalem is Christianity, which clearly, you know, has hugely informed the European ethos. And Athens, the taste for knowledge and rational argument. He sees Athens as the origin of the Enlightenment.
Well, so that's the shift. And in a way, Catholicism, especially in the person of Benedict, is very keen to stress the kind of hyphen there, that there is a close link all the time between that sort of rational tradition and the...
So there's a religious tradition, but also a rational...
Well, you see,
Catholicism, what we now call Catholicism, and perhaps you shouldn't try and project it back on the early church, but the early church did synthesize rationality or rationalism, Greek style, with the Christian faith. And it tried to keep the two of them together from Plotinus on through Aquinas and all kinds of people. And it began to fall apart in the 17th century, using, again, Greek styles of argument, actually.
How would you feel, by the way, you noticed that on that question of definition, that De Rougemont adds the Persians and the Celts? That's one of the great mysteries for me, Tom, is where... What you might define as the specific Celtic contribution.
As you were saying earlier, we don't know very much about our Celtic past, because the Celtic past is fairly thoroughly killed. And also, oddly enough, the far Celtic past was all oral. They made a virtue out of not using writing and by avoiding the alphabet for as long as they possibly could. Yeah. So we know very little about the Druids or their civilization or whatever it was, except that we know it was very powerful. That's all we know about it.
And it
wasn't transmitted, in other words.
We know a little about their legal system, of course, and the Brehon law system. Yeah. And we've got great scholars like Donico Caron and who've really, I suppose, you know, enlightened us about the sophisticated nature of Brehon law.
What does it tell us broadly? I mean, about
it tells
it,
us
system here.
This is the legal system that was, first of all, that was very rules-based, that although it may have been handed down in the oral tradition, as you said, Tom, that there were nonetheless very specific, very consistent rules that applied. They were very rigid in terms of hierarchy, but they did acknowledge a place for women, which wasn't acknowledged in the early common law tradition. And in, within the criminal law, which I'm interested in, it was highly, very much based on restitution rather than on revenge, sort of a movement on from the feuds and the revenge killings. So, you know, we, in some ways, we look back to Brehon law nowadays to see some, to see ideas for how we can reform
our
own legal system.
Yeah, but that was common North European barbarian legal systems. We're all a bit like that. Restitution rather than revenge. Yeah. They tried to replace revenge by restitution as the value of stability among warrior bands. So the idea of the Blood Eric, for example, you know, exists in Germanic law as well.
I
suspect that a lot of the institutions that we call democratic are actually barbarian inventions.
So pre-religion, you know, I mean, there's all these different origins. But I suppose just, you know, to come back to Todorov's idea, I suppose where I think he might be a little more explicit is in the in his discussion of these values that are in, essentially Enlightenment values that he describes as being derived from Athens, from the tradition of rational argument. He's rather overcritical, I think, of A.N. Hirsi Ali in his chapter on the Theo van Gogh killing.
Yes.
I don't know, Tom, if you thought of this, but I felt he was overcritical. He says that she's too scathing of Islam.
Because she's of course the Dutch. Just to be clear on that, I mean, he's saying that she's saying that the roots of 9/11 are to be found in Islam itself. That is quite a claim, isn't it?
Well, she's the victim of a certain form of Islamic practice, if you like. She was clitorectomy. She was treated extremely badly. She was forced to marry somebody she'd never met. She eventually was a fugitive. So her own Manichaeanism is perfectly understandable and excusable, because she is a victim, and there's no doubt about that.
I suppose Todorov is right that what makes the European project unique is that combination of a universality of values with plurality of cultures. If you look at India, China, even the United States, you don't have that. I mean, it's extraordinary what's going on there, isn't it? That you have that system of, I mean, we see the downside of it. We've seen it in recent months. But do you know what I mean, Tommy?
Well, Indian democratic politicians used to always boast that the only thing that kept India together was the fact that there were so many different kinds of Indian. They cancelled each other out, which is not a bad restatement of pluralist political theory, actually. I think Indira Gandhi was particularly fond of that argument, that if the Pakistanis had never seceded, perhaps India would not have remained a democracy. But perhaps if Pakistan and Bangladesh had stayed with the great Indian British Empire, so to speak, the history of modern India might have been a lot less happy than it has been, you know. And I think that Indira would have agreed with me.
But I think it's a good point to make, you know, that the book is about universality of values and plurality of cultures. But there is, I just wonder, does he go far enough in acknowledging the clash that may still occur, even where you're being inclusive and pluralistic? You know, you still come back to this question that he asks at a certain point: how can we distinguish between acceptable traditions and unacceptable practices that are oppositional to democracy and to universal
values?
Well,
I mean, take something like, something like Abu Ghraib, I mean, for example, where you have kind of competing cruelties, if you like, where you have to make decisions about how much of a certain kind of reprehensible behaviour is justified in the interest of the greater good. Those kind of questions are, if you like, pegged at the level of the universal, but they're extremely difficult and complicated questions.
You know, I think Europe has actually not really addressed this kind of problem. The European warrant can permit your extradition to Greece, where you can be put on trial and locked up for life for something you possibly did not do. And the same would apply to Bulgaria and to Romania, two countries with very dodgy legal systems and very alien legal systems from our point of view. Should Irish judges be forced to extradite, to permit the extradition of people living here, two countries, for offences alleged by those countries' governments? I think that's a very, very dangerous idea.
Yeah, I think it does. You're right. I mean, it does beg the question again of to what extent do you are you judgmental and critical of other cultures and other legal systems? And certainly, I suppose the European project has moved so fast in some ways. Perhaps there hasn't been enough scrutiny of criminal justice values in other countries, our system. And again, this harks back to our days as being colonised, that we have such a different legal system that it is, it can be very difficult to see how it fits, particularly the criminal justice system, alongside other criminal justice systems, where, for example, detention before trial is tolerated for much longer durations
exactly.
than we would tolerate here, and subject to less safeguards in terms of bail law. So I think we do have to be cautious about that. And again, you know, Todorov perhaps isn't cautious enough. He says at one point that you're amputating the tradition of the Enlightenment if you denigrate other cultures. That's right, if you're denigrating cultures, but to be critical of value systems, or indeed of the specific example you've given, Tom, of particular rules in a particular or other legal system, I think that's
Are you saying he's not universalist enough, in a sense, is what you're saying?
I suppose I was troubled by this reading the book, and because it's so well argued, you know, I wonder, but I think he could make it clearer that this belief in particular universal values, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, does he accept that those are universal values, should apply across cultures, or is he saying, I think he does accept
he does.
That.
Oh, he does.
But I'm just not sure he's explicit enough about it.
No, no, I think so.
He makes it implicit. The book is actually prophetic.
He does know
that... Manichaean models are dangerous. Yeah. That Manichaeanism means that you have a stereotype of the other, which is oversimplifying and can
be
very, very dangerous.
But he's also saying, apropos your point, that we do have transcultural norms. I mean, that's really... He does seem kind of like... Just a footnote, if you like. Rousseau, he points out, broke with the philosophe in saying the vocation of the human being is to live well with others. You don't need to accumulate knowledge or be a cultivated person. To what extent has that aspect of the tradition been taken up?
I really don't know. It sounds like a definition of democracy to me. All men are equal, or all people are equal before the law.
No matter how little they know.
In other words, it's the old argument about the shoemaker. He may know how to make shoes, but you know how to wear them. You know? And only you know how to wear your shoes.
On that note, we leave it my thanks to Ivana Batrick and Tom Garvin. You can listen to the programme again on our Off the Shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.